Hello? Good evening. It's time to begin our meeting. I'm Randy Fiorini. I'm a member of the Delta Stewardship Council. I serve as the vice chair. I'd like to welcome each of you to this scoping meeting. I assume that most of you know why we are here, and I presume that in turn you know why you're here. We have notice of preparation that's gone out as part of the Delta plan process. Essentially, what we've produced for you is a list, a compendium of ideas that we anticipate should be woven into what will be created and called the Delta plan. Tonight is your opportunity as the interested public to respond to that document and share ideas. We expect probably one or two more council members that will be arriving shortly. Our chairman, Phil Eisenberg, will be here and probably conduct the tail end of the meeting. But we want to provide you with an opportunity to address any issue within pertaining to the notice of preparation. There are blue cards available out at the front desk. If you would kindly fill one out prior to coming to the microphone that's set up in the middle aisle and address whatever issues you would like. After we've completed the scoping portion of the meeting, if anyone has general comments, something other than directly directed at the notice of preparation, we're here to receive those comments as well, but we'd like to separate the two. So we'll take the comments on the notice of preparation first. To introduce the subject a little bit further, I'd like to introduce Joe Grindstaff, the Executive Director of the Delta Stewardship Council, and he'll walk you through a little bit more detail. Joe?
Thank you, Randy. And I have some PowerPoints here. We're anticipating two other members of the council will be here, and they're obviously held up. But I expect Phil Eisenberg and Felicia Marcus both to be here. I want to introduce some other staff just so you'll know who they are. And if you have any questions, feel free to catch them afterwards and ask them all the questions you want. Keith Coolidge, would you raise your hand, Keith? Terry McCauley. Eric Alvarez, there he is over there. Gwen Buchholz is not yet here, but she'll be here any minute. Just got caught up in traffic and is from the area, and she's the program manager for our consulting team. The main purpose today is for us to kind of briefly describe what's supposed to be in the Delta plan, but the main purpose is for us to listen. You know, in the scoping document, we laid out strategies for achieving the objectives. One of the key things I'd like to hear from you is what other strategies should be considered, because there, none of this is guaranteed to be in the final plan, but we're seeking input on what should be in the Delta plan when it finally goes final next year. So that means we're going to talk about this scoping for the major part of the meeting. And then, as Vice Chair Fiorini said, we'll have a period, the after scoping is complete, where people can talk about anything that might otherwise come before the council. So a public comment period. As probably everyone here is aware, last year, actually now it's a year and a half, almost a year and a half ago, the legislature passed a series of bills, a water reform package for the state of California. One of those bills created the Delta Stewardship Council. And we have copies out here for you if you'd like to actually read the legislation. The key part of that bill required that the council develop a Delta plan to help facilitate us achieving the co-equal goals. So it's not that we get there perfectly, but that we actually help towards achieving these objectives, which the state legislature identified. And the co-equal goals were a more reliable water supply, a restored, enhanced ecosystem for the Delta, and protecting the, doing that in a way that preserves and protects the unique values of the Delta as an evolving place. This language is at the core of what the council is supposed to help get done. It's the core of what the Delta Plan is supposed to do. And it's a difficult thing, obviously, or would have been done a long time ago. Probably I don't have to say a lot about what the challenges are and why we need to have a Delta Plan. Certainly there are. The system is failing. It's failing to meet water supply objectives. It's failing to meet ecosystem objectives. It's not doing what we want it to do. It hasn't been for some time. So we're doing this Delta Plan with the expectation that we can attempt to meet that. We're doing this with the expectation that we can attempt. Okay. Is that registering? Yeah, I hear something. Okay. The objectives of the plan are required by law. I want to talk some just briefly about the planning area and the timeline for the plan. The planning area, we've identified kind of a primary planning area, which is the Delta and Suisun Marsh, and a secondary planning area, which is the watershed and all of the export areas. That's a wide area, one that some people aren't happy with. But based on the requirements of the legislation, we felt that's something we had to do. It does cover a lot of people. I think Gwen estimated as 96% of the population of the state falls within that potential planning area. Not everything is going to be addressed in the Delta Plan for that whole planning area. But it's indisputable that exports have an impact on the Delta, and it's indisputable, I think, that upstream actions have an impact on the Delta. So that's why we had to have that secondary planning area. The study period is set for 2100, and that's partly because in the legislation there are some specific objectives with a goal of 2100. And so in order to be consistent with the legislation, at least in this first draft Delta Plan, we're looking at a period that goes all the way to 2100. That's a long time. Frankly, a lot of what happens when you go out so far is not very reliable. But that doesn't stop us from making an attempt to address that in the Delta Plan. As I mentioned earlier, the notice of preparation identified a whole list of potential strategies. And one of the key things we want to find out is, are these strategies viable? Are there strategies we missed, other strategies that the council should consider as they look at developing the Delta Plan? I also want to cover the relationship of the Delta Plan to BDCP. The legislation mentions several plans, including the flood control plan, several plans that could be incorporated into the Delta Plan, but it gave a special place to the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. That's the plan that is being developed by Resources Agency as a way of building conveyance and at the same time creating conservation and getting permits for the operation of the State Water Project. And that plan, under the law, is to be incorporated into the Delta Plan if it meets certain objectives. And the council is given the responsibility, if it meets those objectives and that's certified, of hearing an appeal on that inclusion of the Delta Plan, or of the BDCP in the Delta Plan. So it's kind of an interesting relationship. But it's clearly, it was a very important part of the water package, and it's something that the legislature gave very specific direction to the council about. So BDCP is there and is a factor, and you have to think about that when you're thinking about what happens with the Delta. We're having a series of meetings. This is the third of seven. Next week we have four more of these scoping meetings, and as you can see, we're doing it up and down the state. But beyond that, we're going to have a whole series of meetings about the Delta Plan. So this is scoping. Our hope is, after this closes, to actually have our first draft Delta Plan go public in mid-February. And at the end of February, to have our first public meeting and to go through what a Delta Plan might look like. And then our plan is every month for the next 3 months, so that means four drafts, to have a new draft for the council to go through. And the council has scheduled 4 days of meetings per month to actually walk through the plan, hear the different elements, make decisions about it. And so we'll have a plan in February, we'll have an updated plan in March, we'll have another updated plan in April, and we'll have another updated plan in May, with the goal being at the end of May that the council adopts a plan for formal public comment. So at each of the stages along the way, the council will be holding meetings and asking for comments and input and making decisions on the plan. Then it goes out for formal public comment at the end of May. Probably that means they'll publish it in June, along with the draft EIR, then and take formal public comments on those documents. And when the formal comments come back in, probably at the end of August, they'll begin the process again. We expect to have three more drafts of the Delta Plan. So this is a very intense process. The legislature has set a deadline. They said this plan has to be adopted and being implemented by January 1st, 2012. So in order to meet that deadline, we have to go really fast for a government agency. We have to have these meetings. The council members have to show up and really on an ongoing basis in a way that almost no public council, no state commission would normally do, and address really difficult issues quickly and keep churning through the drafts to try and make really key decisions. So that deadline that's in the legislation is really significant. We expect we will meet that deadline and we'll begin implementation of the Delta Plan January 1st, 2012. In order to do that, we have to adopt the final plan and certify the final EIR in November. Okay. So I want to mention we have a court reporter here tonight. You see her sitting right up here. Everything that's part of the scoping session is being recorded. And will be posted on the website tomorrow. Yesterday's meeting was posted this afternoon, and today's meeting will be posted on the web tomorrow. But we also are having a transcript made, so I will ask you when you come up to give us a blue card and let us help the court reporter have your name spelled accurately, do those kinds of things, so she can document what the comments are. I also want to make a point, if you don't choose to speak verbally and you want to write your comments out and give them to us here, if you want to mail them in to us, If you want to email them in to us, we welcome the input. So any of those things are available. Have the addresses up here on the screen. And it's really important. Our key goal tonight and for the rest of the scoping sessions is to listen, get input from you. So that's what we're doing. When we're done, we'll come back and we'll open it up for other public comments that aren't necessarily tied to scoping. I guess with that, I'm going to hand this over to our chair, who has arrived from jury duty today, and let him take over the scoping meeting.
Hi, I'm Phil Eisenberg. I'm the chair of the Delta Stewardship Council. First, let me apologize. I have been sitting in the Sacramento County Superior Court courthouse all day today waiting for something to happen, and at 10 minutes to 5, some of you have gone through this experience, at 10 minutes to 5 the word came down that the last courtroom that might wish all of us to go off and be questioned has decided they didn't, and then 10 minutes later we were able to process our way out. So I apologize because I hate to be late. Mr. Fiorini?
I need to point out that he was waiting for jury duty, not to be tried.
Well, that's a matter of opinion from some people. Anyway, thank you very much for coming. As you probably know, at the front desk, if people didn't emphasize it, this is a copy of the statute, one part of a multi-bill package the legislature passed and the governor signed in late 2009, which we are implementing. So unlike a lot of study commissions and review commissions and blue ribbon commissions, and you've seen me down here over the years on all of those and many dealing with water, this is one where we actually have a law to follow. And it is for legislation, it's pretty specific on the outlines of the subjects that are concerned. One of the things we'd ask you to do is pick up a copy of the darn thing. I understand it's punishment for all of our sins to have to read a statute. But in this case, it deals with something that Contra Costa County's always been concerned about, which is water. And it's interesting to watch the legislature, after a deadlock of almost 50 years, finally break out and start to do some interesting things. So if you can pick up a copy on the way out, it would be worth it to you. The other thing, I know Randy, our vice chair, and Joe have already explained to you, but this is part of a formal process. The statute says develop a plan. The plan's a legally enforceable state regulation. And therefore, we are doing an environmental impact report on that during this whole time frame. Now, by the way, I should point out, Randy and I are the two council members who are here tonight. And this is primarily a listening session to hear from you. We'll go through endless public hearings on proposals once they're developed and the environmental impact report. But we are only speaking, you know, to the extent we say anything at all, we're giving our individual opinions. The council is not acting tonight. The council only acts in the Delta plan after receiving this infusion of information. And then just the last thing, our website, like all websites, is under construction all the time, but it's operating. And there's a ton of material there already. And for those of you who are water buffaloes, and I detect four or five of them sitting in the room already, you might want to look at the public comments we've received in the 8 months we've been in operation. Is it 8 months? We started in April of last year. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments, and increasingly very significant detailed comments on the structure we're presenting and some of the issues we're going to be studying. And we would strongly encourage you, whatever you need to say here, to send us the written information also. We immediately post it on the website so anybody in the public can read it. But more importantly, it allows us to digest your opinion, to understand completely what you've said, and not try to reconstruct it from memory. And so this process will be going on all through this year until we adopt the Delta plan, and hopefully there we'll have something very similar thereafter for implementation. So we urge you, not that I need to urge anybody in Contra Costa County to write detailed letters, when I was representing East County for 10 years. That was a habit that everybody got into pretty fast if you hadn't done it before. So anyway, pleasure and an honor to be here and to proceed on this thing. Now, what we've done is we've got these funny little blue sheets of paper for people who want to talk. And the reason we ask you to fill them out is the poor court reporter sits over there trying to reconstruct from what you say on kind of tinny microphones, what your name is and the correct spelling and so on. So filling one of these out and printing clearly instructions that I am ordered to follow whenever I fill out a form too would be appreciated. So we've got a bunch of people who've submitted the blue sheets. If there are any of others that would like to, Mr. Alvarez is standing there looking very official with his tie on, and he can collect your blue cards and just come up. We'll take them in the order in which they were delivered. But for the first submission, Mr. Whitley, again, from the Contra Costa Council, and Bob, you've testified, what, three times to us already? I think it is. In one form or another.
One form or another, even when you were chair of the Delta Division.
Well, that was years ago.
That was a long time ago, right. For the record, my name is Bob Whitley. I'm a resident here in Contra Costa in Walnut Creek, and I'm appearing before you as once again as a volunteer. I'm only representing my mind and what I've learned over the last several years. And as co-chair of the Water Task Force for the Contra Costa Council. You will know that I'm very supportive of everything that's gone forth in the development of the legislation. But my emphasis this evening as part of my comments in the scoping sessions relates to the levies. The last time I appeared before the council, your council, Mr. Eisenberg, you challenged me to come up with what my ideas might be as to how you might proceed on developing a Delta plan for levee protection.
I ask you to produce the Whitley plan, as I recall.
So I have not forgotten that, and I do not have a plan, but I'm going to present to you what we've done, in which I discussed with Randy before the meeting, which I'll call the B plan. Now, the B plan is named after Robert B, B-E-A, who appeared at our task force meeting yesterday, very well attended. Several people here in the audience were there. Unfortunately, none of you were there. And so I urge both of you to make the appointment to listen to Dr. Robert B. and his team as to what he thinks the situation is with the levees. He has caused me to rethink my approach to the levees, and I'm still in the process of rethinking that. And as I mentioned to Randy, it's probably going to be a two-part effort if others agree with me. Basically, the B plan says the levee systems, all 1,100 plus miles, are fragile and will fail within the next 90 years. So depending upon the levees, he's pretty blunt about what he thinks about that. He basically says it's stupid. And so how do you go about prioritizing ongoing improvements, which has got to be part of your plan? I mean, it's spelled out, we've said it, but from an EIR point of view, what I'm asking for is to make sure that the EIR is comprehensive in its analysis of the impact of any levee failure at any time on any island or even in the mainland, including the dramatic effects of where there is no plan or there is no improvement. A levee failure could be catastrophic, whether it's today or whether it's with the earthquakes that are going on. So I really do urge, on one hand, you spend the time with Dr. B and his team, but in the EIR, make sure that it's a very comprehensive component of what is the plan, and if there is no plan, what are the consequences that is addressed so that the public really knows the consequences of levee failures.
Maybe you can ask a question. I'd read the Contra Costa Times article on the meeting this morning, and it was in one of the two articles, I thought, that he had discussed the various approaches to levees, one of which is armor everything, defend it to the death, spend whatever it takes. And then there was a second alternative, and I can't remember the precise description of it. Strategic withdrawal, which is also discussed in a Los Angeles Times article about Ventura County yesterday, where they talk about ocean erosion. And the question is, do you defend what's eroding first, or do you take a different approach? I assume you wish to have all the options, or as many rational options as possible, studied in the EIR.
Absolutely, but in answer to your question, Dr. B and his team, I think have, and it's a four-year study funded by National Science Foundation, so they're halfway through it. So they're a work in progress. Their conclusion is, over the next 90 years, to reliably armor the levees is foolish. So his opinion is that the communities have got to figure out how to protect, preserve, respond to the potential of a levee failure, whatever it is, and I don't know whether it means complete withdrawal, but it means the communities, those are infected, that are going to be subject to flooding, need to do more to be prepared as part of the educational process, as part of the policy process, and as part of your planning process.
Did the panel discussion yesterday also include any discussion of the increasing difficulties of local water districts or flood control agencies financing this as a result of perhaps Proposition 26, which was just approved in the last election, arguably limiting the use of fees unless approved by voters directly?
The only comment that the panel made regarding funding is recognizing that many applicants, all they want to do is go after state and federal money, but that's not the solution. Like any disaster, any failure, you got to be prepared yourself. How do you go about preparing yourself? And then how does your plan address all of that? And then, of course, how does the EIR? The EIR, of course, becomes the vehicle for decision making and public information. And it's only one piece of the public information. I mean, it was very pointed why Mike was at that meeting yesterday and wrote that article yesterday or this morning. And interestingly, I found out that that article was picked up by the Miami Herald and was on the streets of Miami before I got up this morning. So his message is very much about the importance of getting public information, education as to the risks that are really out there.
And the to be submitted shortly in the future Whitley plan will also give us the options and alternatives on cost-sharing responsibility, what to do with levees that are not currently legally required to be maintained by either the federal government or the state, and you know what are called non-project levees?
The Whitley plan is smart enough not to get into that discussion.
You've got to do it. The cost implications are staggering.
The Whitley plan at this point is, where does the Contra Costa Council, with whatever influence it has within this community and with the county, start to address these risks? And how does PG&E, how does Caltrans, how do the water districts, how does the major industries that are aligned along, how do they all interact in a way? Dr. B's approach is, and they're recommending, they've all got to work together and not just depend upon a state agency to come in and bail them out. So my emphasis right now is rethinking what Dr. B is saying to us and then how do I move that ball along within the controversy? And so I don't think I'm going to be alive at the time that the cost sharing discussion really comes fruitful.
Oh yes, you will, because it's going to happen in front of us this year. Unfortunately, there's no way out of it.
But I do urge your council, your staff, to devote several hours with Dr. B and his team, and learn from a man who has investigated Deepwater Horizon, Katrina, levee failures along the Mississippi River, and basically what he is saying is at his senior status, he doesn't want to see the he is trying to convey the lessons learned from all those investigations in advance of what might be a catastrophic failure in the levee. You must hear that.
Thank you, sir. Okay, the next person is Mr. Zlotnick from the State Water Contractors. Mr. Zlotnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Greg Zlotnick, the State and Federal Contractors Water Agency. And I would just like to start by echoing Mr. Whitley's comments and indicating our support for the levee program being a key and integral factor in the Delta Plan development, consistent with the legislation in terms of strategic investments that can be made, and also working with Central Valley Flood for also maintenance and other things that are directly in the direction from the legislation. Want to thank you for holding these meetings and commend you for all the hard work. We know it's a tight timeline, as we saw in the presentation by Joe, and as you know, we're here to help.
I was just teasing Randy a bit, and I said, should I ask him if this means the State Water Contractors
we'll
are now
everything.
Interested in paying for it?
Everything.
Okay. Everything? Oh, would you write that down? That's
yeah,
interesting.
Right.
That question is only said, it's not said facetiously, because there are a host of people who have interest in flood control, not just the property owners and the people who work there, but the people who rely on water and the utilities whose lines, power lines and water lines and gas lines and all that, and the railroads that cross the Delta mm-hmm. and the latter, and pay nothing for
right.
flood protection at the present time, expecting others to pick it up.
We fully expect beneficiary pays.
For those of you in the back who couldn't see, Mr. Zlotnick was pointing in two directions, the usual way those discussions go. Somebody else's responsibility to pay.
But anyway, I just wanted to appreciate the comments that Bob made and think that is definitely central to your activity and the Delta Plan.
I know you, the contractors have made to us many comments, and I think there have been some passing references to the levees, but are you intending to be more comprehensive in your comments to us in the near future on what would be an appropriate levy policy?
My guess is we'll probably be looking to see where you start and then react to what you have to say. But I just for purposes of the NOP, directly our comments are that we do believe that the NOP is a bit broad, and we understand it was intentionally so for the NOP, because you can always narrow it down. We would certainly encourage the narrowing down of what's there. Particularly since it's a programmatic effort, and understanding what that means and the integration into all the other activities that will be going on in the Delta, not just the BDCP, which we appreciate you referencing in your materials, but the Central Valley Flood Plan and the Delta Conservancy Plan and Delta Protection Commission plans, all these plans, which as you identify and appreciate, you're saying that they're not going to be done by the time you need them, but that you're open to incorporating in sort of a phased approach what might make sense from those reports. So we certainly support that as well. And that also includes the Delta County's HCPs that are being developed as well. We do think that you should really, in that narrowing, stay focused on the Delta proper. We do understand, as Mr. Greinstaff explained, the secondary planning area and why that's included. But in terms of the focus of activities and things that you would be promoting, we do think that the focus needs to stay in the Delta proper. In terms of activities that are more sort of general water management issues in the state, We think that the language in the legislation is pretty clear, that the word often used is promote. And in our view, promote does not mean the same thing as developing specific protocols and other things, but actually finding ways to encourage, support, facilitate, what have you, those activities consistent with what the legislation says should be promoted. And in reference to that, we do also think in the NOP, the inclusion of the policy in section 85021 related to reduced reliance is not an appropriate state policy that would be used to, quote-unquote, define objectives of your plan.
Greg, let me ask you to pause there. Ladies and gentlemen, there's so much complicated legal talk and code talk that let me just highlight what he's talking about. A section of the statute said it's the intention of the legislature that there be decreased reliance on the Delta for future export of water. And there is that's part of the law. There is a raging debate going on. Mr. Zlotnick's one of the participants. There are a couple others here tonight doing the same thing, each of whom have their own opinion of what the language actually means. Most Delta residents say, and Delta County say, well, that means you got to cut way back any exports from the Delta now and starting on. Mr. Zlotnick has a different argument that it refers to future increases in water, if I can shorthand the summary, Greg. That is merely one of the complications that come when you do big, complicated legislation. So what he's talking about in that is how we have to interpret the statute that was passed, and ultimately somebody's going to sue somebody over something, and the court's going to tell us what it actually says.
With respect, Mr. Chairman, it's not just the interpretation of the statute, which is there, but for the purposes of this evening, it's really whether or not it's appropriate to be used as something defining an objective of your plan, which is how it's couched in the NOP. And that's a different issue that we also do not agree with. And I think with that, I will just let you know that we will be submitting more formal written comments prior to the deadline on the 28th.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. The next is Tom Lindemuth. Mr. Lindemuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Tom Lindemuth. I live in Oakley, right in the heart of the Delta, and until late last year, I was the president of the Delta Science Center. So with a little apologies, I have some science to lay on you. My concern is this. In looking at the plans so far, the plan itself is extraordinarily complicated, but in large part exists in many separate issues with not a great deal of logical interconnection, and also without a great deal of cause and effect type of analysis. I want to give you one issue that I've been concerned about and that my colleagues and I have been working on for the past 7 or 8 years, and that is the impact of nutrients into Delta waters and what they do to the aquatic ecosystem. It's not a subject that has been largely studied, partly because it's an ephemeral thing. Now you say, well, if it only happens a little once in a while, why bother? And the reason is that when what I want to describe happens, nothing that swims or crawls lives there at all. Everything dies. It's an acutely toxic condition. It happens in the summertime. When I say summertime, summertime in the Delta, which is half the year. Presence of light, presence of Egeria densa in particular, an aquatic weed, shallow zones in a tidal ecosystem with nitrates in the water above a threshold of about 2 milligrams per liter. In other words, we have done enough work to say this is the box in which this problem exists. Few scientists have seen it because sampling work is usually done in the morning. This problem happens every single afternoon. And what happens is dissolved oxygen readings go off the chart. In general, that's not too bad. However, the pH rises every day to between 9.5 and 10. And with even the tiniest traces of ammonia in the water, that condition is acutely toxic, lethal to everything that might swim through the zone, except perhaps an adult carp. We've seen a few adult carp. But no benthic invertebrates, almost nothing in the benthos itself, and nothing swimming. And so my concern is this. The phenomena does not happen everywhere. However, it surely will happen every place where people want to go and restore habitat for fish rearing. The fish rearing habitat will be the ideal place for this to happen, and it will turn, instead of a breeding ground, it'll be a killing ground. And we have enough data for me to stand up and say this will happen, because it happens every single time. Now, the solution, if you will, or at least what needs to be addressed, is nitrogen loads into the delta waters, both ammonia and nitrate. Nitrate is the driving force for the completely out of control photosynthesis. To give you an idea, the photosynthesis runs so fast that the water foams like opening a bottle of champagne. You look down into it and there are bubbles boiling out of it. And nothing's living there. So a criteria that needs to be seriously addressed is how and who pays for reducing those nitrogen inputs. And the really difficult point is those who are likely to have to pay, the ratepayers, for example, for wastewater treatment, are not the folks who will benefit. Matter of fact, the beneficiaries swim and crawl. They don't open their wallets to pay. And likewise, the size of the impact, or the size of the project, if you will, to address this impact is clearly of the same order of magnitude as we look at for levy issues. It is not small at all. But the nice thing is that there is, at least we've got the start of a cause and effect relationship, and secondly, that the technology to do these nitrogen reductions is already in hand. It's been demonstrated all over the world, and it can be done. And I think it really needs to be, the work needs to be expanded in terms of how broad the impact is. A great deal of our studies, although not all of them, but were done in the Big Break region of the Delta, which of course is the ideal habitat, used to be ideal habitat for salmon rearing. Of course it isn't anymore. So that's why I wanted to bring that to your attention. I will put together something more definitive. I presented these same findings at the Bay Delta Science Conference in September, but it needs to be put into a paper as well.
We would, in fact, appreciate receiving that. And also, as you probably know, part of our duty was to appoint an independent science board for the Delta, which we've done, and it's got a whole bunch of pretty top-notch people, including international scientists. Mm-hmm. It's not just Delta area scientists. And they are currently engaged in a study of what's called stressors on the Delta, Mr. Fiorini's request, mm-hmm. kind of a common catchword, but it's everybody's favorite right. target for criticism. But it's a helpful way to look at a very complex puzzle, and nutrients is part of that. And just one thing I wanted to mention, we put our toe in the water, so to speak, on the nutrients and the wastewater treatment plant by essentially forwarding to the Regional Water Control Board our Delta lead scientist evaluation, mm-hmm. that their staff recommendation to the Sacramento Regional Plant was improper and scientifically justified, and the council supported that activity, what, a month and a half, 2 months
right,
ago.
Right, I'm aware of that, and that's a very good start.
Okay, but we get us what you want us to look at as fast as you can, if you would, please, because it takes time to get through all these people.
I understand.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Martin, Ms. Maureen Martin, Contra Costa Water District.
Good evening. My name is Maureen Martin from the Contra Costa Water District, and I have 5 points that I'm going to make for you this evening. So we're going to still request that the Delta Plan consider immediate actions to improve conditions in the Delta before lots of the long-term strategies can be implemented. We're also going to request that you guys make a determination of operations and flows that are necessary for in-basin users, senior water rights holders, and fisheries, and basically what's remaining is available for exports. Great. Greg loves that.
We'll tell you what that all meant in a minute, but it's a big fight.
Yes. As you can imagine, official written comments are coming. Also related to the BDCP, we would like to see a clearer resolution on how the BDCP is going to be incorporated since the schedule has been delayed. And that in both the BDCP and the Delta plan so far, there's been mention of that salinity could increase under certain conditions to possibly benefit the environment or given certain operations. And there needs to be a discussion in both the plans of an effort to minimize any water quality impacts and discussion of fully mitigating any remaining impacts. And finally, the Delta plan should include a financing plan that recognizes the beneficiaries of Delta improvements are broad-based and that the project cost should be assigned to all beneficiaries. So that's a long list of things.
That's a long list.
You can just imagine how long the comment letter is going to be.
The comment's probably going to be 75 pages. We got a comment letter with attachments of 222 pages yesterday.
I don't have time to write
Ms. Marcus, will you please get up here? A third council member's just arrived, Felicia Marcus. Did you introduce yourself, Randy? Okay, as you know, Randy Farms in Turlock, for those who come in late, he's the vice chair. Ms. Marcus is deceptively innocent-looking, but is the West Coast Regional Director of National Resources Defense Council, former federal EPA a top assistant during the Clinton administration, and a formidable person. Lives in the Bay Area.
All right. Anyway.
I should probably say, of the items that were just mentioned, and just let me just run down what it is, that there are a couple, you know, there's a big fight about when and whether and when the State Water Resources Control Board should try to take another crack at setting flow standards for water quality in the Delta and water quality for fish species, for human use, all that kind of stuff. And of course, by implication, the Water Board, which has been doing that since 1967, I think was the first decision. Don't hold me on the date, but it's very close to that time. Each time they've kind of, in very confusing ways, set a little bit higher standard. We've been struggling to get a flow standard for the last 20X years. It was stopped once when a lawsuit stopped the Water Board from proceeding, told them to start over again. Then a previous governor got involved and didn't like the process. So it's been percolating, and it's bubbled up because the legislation that created us called for the Water Board to do a flow study focused only on environmental protection, not on what they would do in a legal proceeding, which is applying something called the public trust doctrine, which is a balancing test across interests that has constitutional status. That's lawyer talk, but it's a big, hot, complicated, but important deal. The struggle here has been, and Mr. Zlotnick and Ms. Martin have talked at each other on this and other points several times during our process, and this is merely one exchange. So that's one that you're pointing about. And then the other one, the financing impacts, was the fact that CCWD is one of the water districts that urges a fairly broad understanding of the definition of beneficiaries. Clear people live in the Delta benefit by improvements, but I think it's fair to say CCWD believes that the railroads benefit that run through the Delta, the power lines benefit, the water exporters who take water from the Delta, and although I haven't asked yet, you probably think that everybody who lives in the Delta watershed and prevents some water from reaching the Delta that used to get here ought to participate too.
That's but I'm probably not close, but yeah. I don't have the details.
Anyway,
yes,
another
the broader,
very
the better,
complicated
typically.
Issue. Thank you very much,
okay,
Ms. Martin.
Thank you.
Appreciate that very much. Mr. Rizzi. Joseph Rizzi. There you are. We've been getting some email from you lately that I think has been posted on the web. Please, if you would.
Well, I'm wanting to
introduce yourself for the electronic record, because we're posting a copy of the tape of this on the website.
Joseph Rizzi with naturaldesalination.org. And
Okay, and that's your website address, too,
I assume. That is what my website address as well. What I'm trying to propose, or I'd like to see in the EIR, is new sources of water for the public to replace what is going down south and what is needed for the farmers in the, as well as all the rest of California. We're not really looking at any new sources of water. And natural desalination is not desalination. What people normally see as desalination is a big plant on the shore that's going to be taking water out of the ocean, and it takes up a lot of room, and it uses a lot of energy and a lot of expense in order to desalinate that water. Natural desalination is not that. It's placing the desalination plant offshore 10 miles at a half mile underneath the ocean. By putting it down at the bottom of the ocean, you can get that 1,000 pounds per square inch of desalination pressure in order to naturally desalinate the water, as much water as California needs. And I know that seems like a lot, but the more water we put into the Delta area, or for the farmers, that means you get more of the flow, and you get more flow, you don't have as many problems. The fish are happier, and we don't. The more water we get in for Southern California, the more we don't have to export down to Southern California. So making water or adding new water supplies, as well as if you're taking the water off the coast in the ocean, you've got a cleaner source of water for the public. And you're desalinating it, so it also makes it more safer. Any kind of terrorist acts or anything else?
I actually went to your website, and I skimmed some of the newspaper stories in one of your briefing papers, but I went to the website, and I'm not a scientist, but explain to me, I understand pressure at a certain depth in the ocean is a tool you use generating, processing, whatever you do on reclaimed or desalted water from the ocean. How substantial a body of scientific and engineering evidence is available that massive developments similar to what you describe are currently feasible technologically? I just don't know.
That's a fair question. California is a state in which we have a lot of invention, and this is exactly what this is. This is a new idea. It is backed by, it is already well known that 1,000 pounds per square inch is what it requires to desalinate water, seawater, in order to make it into usable water for us. And if you go down a half mile down in the ocean and you have positive pressure on the inside and you have 1,000 pounds per square inch on the outside, you will desalinate as much water as the state can use. And that's the nicest part about it. I have talked to the scientists at the water board, and they said, oh yeah, that seems to work really good. But what they keep doing is they keep thinking of it as the existing desalination process with these little plants that, oh, a desalination plant can only handle enough or produce enough water for a small city or even part of a city. No, I'm not talking about it that way. When you talk about Saudi Arabia, you look at those desalination plants that are, you know, miles long on the beach. I'm talking about that kind of structure or that kind of processing down at the bottom of the ocean, all using natural powers of the difference in between pressures inside the tube, which is at zero atmospheric pressure, and the outside, which is at 1,000 pounds per square inch at all points on the desalinating process, reverse osmosis, which has been around for years.
Sir, thank you very much. I don't know enough to be intelligent on the subject. No, wait a minute. You're going to get another chance as soon as I go through the rest of the speakers here.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. The next speaker is Mr. Hiram Sibley. Mr. Sibley. There you are. We missed you down in Manteca, your neck of the woods. We were there last night.
I didn't know that. I only read in the paper about this meeting tonight. And so I
Merced.
Beat feet up here from Manteca, where I live.
Merced.
And I don't know where, I've never heard of all these meetings, but I'd read a couple little articles that they were having them somewhere. And my name is Hiram Sibley. I live in Manteca. I have a business and farms over there. And I personally have about a mile of levees around my place. And I'm in two particular districts, and one of them takes care of their levees very well, and the other one doesn't do much of a job. We do have a little problem, though, that people who take care of their levees have problems with the state all the time about, we put concrete block, you know, chip concrete pieces, chunks, along our levee wall for quite a long period. And then we were told that we have to tear it all out because quite possibly, and we're not, it wasn't in the water itself, it was up on the bank, and we were told to take it away because it's some kind of asbestos that could cause downstream when it's at very high tides, of course we know it's all going to the ocean anyway, but the point is here's a particular group of people who are doing everything they can to maintain these levees in great shape, and it's basically to the ocean side of Manteca, where the last in 97 we had a flood because they didn't take care of their levees, but we happened to be flooded out because we couldn't control the only location where water came through, and that was a bridge underpass under 5, and we were going to do something about it. And the highway patrol came there and symbolically arrested everybody there because they said, no, you'll flood 5 and you got to be flooded because we can't allow you to protect your property in this form. And so that's kind of some of my experiences here. We also around this particular levee here on Old River that goes directly to the plant. There's an area behind my golf course there that the sand is so bad in there that there's a little boat launching place up the road. And at certain times of the year, especially in the summer, you can't get the boat through. And it's probably only 3 feet or 4 feet in there now because they haven't desanded that particular area for, 40 years, somewhere in that area?
Well, the levees were designed in part, I think, to avoid the strong waters, currents that would come occasionally and scour out the sand.
Yeah.
The best I'm no expert.
Well, I'm just
on this,
saying that, this is the response we get from the state. As far as I know, we never had any state
money. Are they what are called project levies down there?
Well, we both have the state and the federal.
I mean the designation. Are the levies what are called project levies where the federal government has agreed to assume some share of responsibility?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay, so they're what are called non-project levies.
Right, and we're maintaining of that. This is a good district, that particular one. Anyway, my big concern here about this whole, I hear all these scientists, and I'm just a layman. I'm a farmer. I've experienced all this salt in the water. About 6 years ago, I got so much salt in it that came through that it killed a whole corn crop on 100 acres, and we had UC Berkeley, come out and verify that, yes, we got some serious salt. And so I couldn't grow on that property for about 7 years, and they even give me a tax break because it was so inundated. On my golf course, every summer, we get, when high tides come in, we do get salt. And I'm right in that whole area there. And I just don't think that until we take care of where the water's coming from and get rid of the salt in that particular area that's going south, how we can send any more water south, because if you take more water away from me, I'm going to have more salt intrusion that's coming up on high tides. And it's ridiculous. If you don't want to take care of us and you want to take all the water, then you should be buying me out. My personal point of view is that Southern California has a program, and that's to get as much water as they need or want all the time. Now, have they even done a compromise? Do they pay more for water than we do up here? I don't think much, because it doesn't seem to slow it down at all. I think by raising the price of water, you know, if you look at bridges here, who pays for the bridges? We do. We use it. We pay for it. Southern California people don't pay for our bridges here. We do, in the form of compensation for the maintain the bridge and wherever else they use the money. But in Southern California, the last 2 years, I thought they had more water than we had. Is there any form of reservations down there, reservoirs, to hold some of this water back?
Yeah, the biggest reservoir recently built in California is in the Inland Empire.
They need a ton more. I see the the Los Angeles River? It flows like no tomorrow. And that's quite a river that runs down there. It's a lot bigger than San Joaquin River.
by the way, of all the water that is exported from the Delta, water that goes across the Tehachapi to urban Southern California is the smallest part. It's about 20% of the total. It's a lot of water, 1.5 million acre feet. But the others is largely used by the Central Valley agriculture, coastal regions. It's diverted by San Francisco and some of the other things. So it's not just a regional problem on water. It's a statewide problem.
No, I'm not talking about a regional problem. I'm talking about more of a compromise. It's time for them to pick up their side of the coin. We keep giving more and more and more. I mean, they were taken more than they were presumably allocated a couple of years ago. As I read, I mean, I'm just like you say, I'm just a layman, so I just pick up pieces of information here and there.
Well, the voters of California, albeit narrowly, authorized the construction of the state and the federal water projects for the purpose of exporting water.
Well, I realize that, but, you know, just as this hall is packed with hundreds of people or thousands of people, that this will affect their life. As we put more water down into Southern California, what happens to when 30 years or 20 years from now, when people want to grow up here and you say, well, we need more water. Well, oh my darn, we have none for us. We've been so nice, we gave it all away. And I'm concerned about these kind of things. I realize that I don't have any of the answers, but as a person who lives this life, mm-hmm. I'm not letting any of my water on a golf course go back to the river. So I know I'm not polluting a damn thing. None of my water on my farm from the dairy goes back to the river. I'm conscientious in what I'm doing. I just wish some of these other people, instead of greed, 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 money, 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 because it's all for new development down there, would think about, hey, what do we got to give up? These people that are scientists and that, there are things, yes, I understand, that if you've got water that isn't flowing very well up here, that you're going to have problems with fish. You realize it's been the last 2 years that I'm enclosed on three sides with rivers, different ones, but Old River on one of them. I don't see the birds anymore that used to feed on the fish that used to bring in the salmon and the doggone rest of the fish. They're not there. I used to see them about every 4, 5, 6 days, 10 days. There they are, just swarming, going after the swarms of bait fish. They're not there. I don't know where they are. They're gone, apparently. But I mean, I don't have to have scientific study for this stuff. I'm seeing it. I'm seeing the amount of salt I'm getting on my golf course. I'm seeing it because of influxes in tide when it comes in, because you're taking almost too much. They don't want to hear that kind of story. They want to hear the story about, oh, we'll go underneath and take it away. Do you think that all that water they're going to take is going to make it any better for me as far as the intrusion of salt? I think not. I think it's going to get worse. And of course, I don't know this scientifically because I haven't gone and done all the tests every week, but I damn well know this isn't right. And some of these other things ought to be looked at before we say, hey, we signed off, they get $20 billion gallons of water or whatever amount you want to say they get extra, because you people are looking at two plans. I don't mind you looking at the plans, but the point is the people up here in Northern California need to be heard And it should affect, it is going to affect us, no matter what you do. But we ought to have some say in what's going to happen. We're not the voting majority, but we are damn well going to live with a consequence. Thank you.
That's one of the reasons, Mr. Sibley, we're having meetings like this. Okay, thank you very much. Let's see, Mr. Bird Morningstar. Says here, the happy gardener wishes to talk. That's you? Okay, there you are. I'm sorry, couldn't see you.
Welcome, people on the board and the audience. I'm a Bird Morningstar. I'm the owner of a small family business known as the Happy Gardener, and we are a pest and water management company. And what I want to talk to you about, do you know about the state ordinance?
Could you do me a favor? Could you pull that mic down? Joe's going to lower the mic and then get a little closer to it so we can have a good recording, which we'll post on
it's
the website.
Oh, echoing
please.
In my ear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you aware of the ordinance AB 1881?
It's an assembly bill that was legislation passed, yes.
Yes. Under that bill, it's a pretty nice bill, as you know. It's asking to conserve water 10% by the year 15 and by the year 20 to conserve 20% throughout the state. Within that bill, there's a lot of good ideas, you know, about how much turf you can have. They don't tell you how much to have, but they recommend it. They talk about midways. But the main thing they talk about is about the ET controller. That is a smite controller that runs by satellite or can also run by...
evapotranspiration controller, correct. Your notion.
Yes. And it talks about that. One of the things about this bill, when it was passed, it didn't have any proposal arguments against that. And actually, the bill says it was unknown. Actually, so there was no really effort made to find any agreement against this bill. Which I find it's unusual because the one thing about it does say that the ET controllers will have to be used in all landscapes that have automatic sprinklers, and you know, by the year 20. And this is, I'm talking about in residential. And also, they allowed this bill to pass before the program was completed, was the Elevation Water Basin Program. I don't know if you've seen this.
Mr. Grindstaff's nodding yes. I can't read it from here, so I don't know which one you're talking
about. Well,
is this an implementation document from somebody? Okay. Oh, this is the Urban Water Conservation Council evaluation.
Right.
And this was from July of 2009.
2000, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I've seen it referred to. I'd not read the full report.
Okay. But anyway, that bill was allowed, the bill was allowed to pass before this program was done. And so a lot of things were brought into to play before this bill was done. And the problem with that is once that this program was done, well, unfortunately, it proved that the smite controller wasn't as smite as we thought it was going to be. And the real problem I have with it is they claim this smite controller is... new technology, and the ideas, depending on how you're going to use it, it's a satellite that's going to come and set your clock, and then and inside your home, it's going to do things. You got to evaluate things like your soil type of plants you got, drought-tolerant plants, the environment, and all these little things you have to understand before you can program this clock. The only problem with that is that this is asking homeowners, gardeners, and all of this to do this. And it's supposed to be proven by science, but the science ends, it just absolutely ends the minute you enter that yard. Because once you enter that yard, there's too many things going on that they're asking for. One thing is, the climate. Inside of a yard, your climate can change in a yard 10, 15 different locations. Radiating sun. Well, you know, they talk about radiating heat to set your clock. Well, that's nice, but radiation, the minute I put a hat on, radiation doesn't exist anymore. And it's the same with trees, houses, and all of that. So using that form doesn't really work out. And the one thing about this clock, they say it's modern technology, but the truth is there's no modern technology here because all they really did was change the look of the clock. instead of the clock being easier to be set now, now they're going to say it's going to be done via internet or some other function. But the clock itself has not changed. The function of the clock is still the same. It's still days, hours, and minutes. It's still that function. So the clock function hasn't changed. So if you go through all of these changes that you're asking for, the clock is still going to have to say, okay, well, what's water on Tuesday at 3 o'clock for 15 minutes? So you're going through all of this type of work to put a change in this clock that you didn't do nothing new at all. It's just that you, instead of myself going out to program it, you're allowing the satellite to do this program, and you're asking that the information is to be right in that information. We also ask, you know, if that to be proven by science that this ET is to work. That's the main thing about this whole thing, is that we want science to prove this thing. Well, that's good, but, you know, the water companies have been pushing this. You know, there's quite a lot of them. You know, they go to Northern California and Southern California. All together, they start in 2,294 of these clocks. Only 411 in Northern California, and in Southern California, 1,800. Big difference. It's almost like apples and oranges, what you're going to see in Northern California and what you're going to see in Southern California. So that's a big change there. And also, this program putting together, they try to tell us, to sell this to us, that our clocks are old-fashioned, the clocks that we use today. Well, that bothered me. So I went to my supplier, because I just installed a clock the other day. And I asked my supplier, are you telling me that you sold me an old-fashioned clock? Of course, he said, well, not at all. We're trying to sell you the highest technology that we have. But I'm saying, and I showed him the piece of paper. I guess I have it. No, I have it right here, actually. Where they're actually, this is East Bay Mud's flyer to sell this thing, and they're actually saying, you know, this looks like an old-fashioned irrigation clock, but it's smarter and more convenient. And they also say that a traditional clock just turns water on and off at a set schedule, which is the same as what the ET controller does. But they make it sound like that the traditional clock is going to do everything wrong. And the only way it's going to be right is to use this ET controller. But through all of that, and then you put the science into that, and the science proved that to be absolutely wrong. If you look at some of the results, the only savings, when this thing was all done, the Northern California was only able to save 6.8%, and Southern California was only able to save 5.6%. And they were claiming to try to sell this to us, that we were going to get anywhere between 10 to 30%. And we couldn't even get half of that. And if you look at all of these different water departments, like let's take East Bay Mud, they were only able to sign up 333 people, even though they have over a million clients. And out of that amount, the best they could do was 5.8%. If you look at Contra Costa Water
District. Mr. Morningstar, excuse me, do you have a recommendation?
Yes, I do.
Great.
Yeah.
Did you get to it?
Okay, the recommendation is, okay. The ET thing, science has proven that it doesn't work. So the really thing is that this ET program turned out to be snake oil. Because snake oil is whenever someone makes a claim and science proves it to be different, and science did that. The recommendation is here that this is going to have a big impact on our delta, because now we're going to see more water, wasted water, going to the delta, and other parts without California that's going to carry pesticides and fertilizer. Because one thing I've been in water conservation for a long time, and I've learned that this program is going to encourage mites inside the yards, and it's also going to allow the more use of fertilizers, because it's not going to keep the lawn as green as this method works, so people are going to add more. So you're going to see the increase of more pollution into the delta, plus the amount of wasted water going back. So my recommendation is this ET controller needs an environment impact report. We need to see actually how this ET controller is actually going to work and get away from this idea of selling it, getting away from it, because the science is showing it that it's not working. So the impact report needs to be done to make sure that our delta is getting good, clean water returned from this particular program.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. After the next speaker, Mr. Lindemuth, we're circling back to you. Mr. Tim Donahue, chair of the Delta Sierra Club. Mr. Donahue? There you are.
Good evening. First of all, I want to thank you for holding the hearing here in the area of the Delta. I represent the Delta Group of the Sierra Club, which of course is right there in Antioch, all the way up to Discovery Bay, up to Martinez, basically. I've been a resident of that area since 1984. I'm familiar with the Delta. I'm a boater, been on the Delta many times. I used to live here in Concord before that. I've observed personally, of course, the situation with the Delta, with the reduction in the flows and the impact of the salinity caused by the pumping that's sending water elsewhere in the state. And the degradation of the Delta. The fisheries, of course, have collapsed. Certain fishes have collapsed. The striper population is way down, and the steelhead run is almost non-existent. So we realize what's happened, and this thing has now been studied just about to death. The problem is a lot of money has been spent, but none of it has really had any impact, and we're still arguing what should be done. The bottom line is we have to acknowledge that there is a limited amount of water. Period. You can't make it. I mean, this nonsense about making water from the ocean is too damn costly at this point in our technological ability. So we've got a limited amount of water, and we've got a state that has blossomed population-wise since I moved here in 1971. Well, we've got 37 million people here now. When I came here in 71, it was, I think, somewhere around 25 million. So the reality is we've got more demand than water. The reality is not everybody is going to get what they want. The reality is that we've got to protect the environment or we'll have nothing. We'll be drinking sewage. That's the reality. Now, the political reality is that Southern California has more control in the legislature than Northern California. Now, we were successful in defeating the peripheral canal back in the 80s. People didn't buy that idea. I have a problem with the concept of diverting water around the Delta. I can understand if we move the intakes further up, we'll draw potentially less salinity up because the pipe, the pumps themselves won't be that draw that almost reverses the flow of water now in low flow times. But no one has been able to explain to me how less water in the Delta results in improving the water quality. It doesn't make any sense to me. But that's the reality. I can see it coming. Anybody else thinks that this thing is going away, forget it. It's here to stay. So the EIR, this needs to address a number of things. First of all, it needs to address the impact on the quality of water that would be remaining in the Delta if this diversion takes place. Taking into account the farm pesticides and fertilizers that are already a problem in the Delta, the sewage contaminants from sewage treatment facilities along the Delta, in particular Sacramento, the water's coming in from the San Joaquin. And one issue that has just cropped up in the last couple of years is the issue of pharmaceutical deposits. That is, people through their urination into the sewage system, into the water treatment system, people flushing pills down the toilet, blah, 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 blah. what impact that has on the water quality and the aqua system and the living items that are the fish and so on, the bacteria, blah, 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 that are in the water itself. That needs to be scientifically and thoroughly addressed so we know really what we're going to end up with. Conservation. Now, the Contra Costa Water District in the last several years and the East Bay Water District has requested voluntary conservation during our period of droughts. And it's been a great success. They've met and surpassed the guidelines that they set out. So conservation has got to be a key to this. And I mean, it still bugs me that Sacramento, as I understand it, now gone and put in water meters, but they aren't hooked up. So some of them. Okay. But I mean, it's insane. If you're using water, everybody ought to be on a meter. There's no free lunch anymore.
That's the state law. Non-metered residential homes have until the year 2025 to phase in a mandatory metering throughout the whole state. And it's not just Sacramento, although it's the biggest community. A large part of communities, Lodi, parts of Stockton, I think even, could be wrong on that one, but Central Valley towns and areas which are near rivers have historically avoided metering because the supplies were pretty abundant.
That's right. Okay. Farming is still, as I understand it, about using about 70% of the water that is diverted. So there should be strict implementation of water conservation practices in the farming community. Some farming entities have done a good job with different types of irrigation system instead of just flooding their fields. It depends on the crop and depends on the time of year and so on. That also relates to the type of crops grown. Okay, there are some crops that really we don't need to grow. They're not a food-based crop, and they use a lot of water. You know, cotton is one of them. There's just simply not enough water.
I used to argue that a lot on the peripheral canal battle, and we convinced the Central Valley farmers to reduce their cotton growing by about two-thirds, but of course they planted permanent crops, and in dry years, if you have vines or trees, they die without water, where with cotton, you can fallow a field, and if you get water the next year, turn right around.
Yeah, there's
it's pretty complicated.
Yeah, it is a combination of the irrigation and the crop that's being grown. I mean, I'm not an expert in farming. I'm more of an expert in landscaping. Okay. Reclaimed water. There needs to be a large push on reclaimed water. Now, there has been, I know out in the Tassajara Valley and Doherty Valley, the new projects there in San Ramon, part of the requirement of that those projects out there required that right-of-way along highways, golf courses, and so on be required to use reclaimed water. That needs to be looked at. There shouldn't be a golf course in the state that isn't using reclaimed water. So that needs to be stressed. In Southern California, what really gets me, I was down there, my daughter lives down there, and I was down there over the Christmas holidays, and of course they had record rains this year. You all saw it on the TV, you know. And they have record snows. But they have no ability to trap any of that water because they didn't need to. It was coming from us up here at the north end. They didn't need to worry about it. It still irks me during our previous drought in the 80s that I remember flying down there to my office down in Southern California, and I'd be putting bricks in my toilet up here, never washing the car, watching my yard dry up, and they were down there watering the sidewalks. So I don't understand why, especially with new housing developments down in Southern California, why there is not an ability to reclaim that water, to store that water either below ground or in, you know, they've got a bunch of canyons down there that they're so concerned with all the time because they burn over all the time. We see that on the TV. I don't understand why in some of those areas there cannot be a catch basin that catches that water and then is put in some kind of an underground storage. If anything, it could be used as reclaimed water. Obviously, you couldn't use it to drink because it'd have to be treated. But it makes no sense that all that water that fell down there just went out to the sea and not a dime's worth was saved. Likewise, in Southern California, I know the Southern California Water District has attempted to put in different programs to conserve water, and they've had success. So conservation, I think, is, again, a key to this program. And from what I understand, the people were receptive to it down in Southern. They just have to be given the facts. They have to be given the fact, look, if we don't conserve, there won't be any water. You're going to have to leave California and move to whatever. Finally, I think that there should be water use priorities set because there is a limited, finite supply. And within that framework, you've got people, Metropolitan Water District supplying water to people. You've got the environment, the fisheries, and so on. You've got the farms. You've got industry. And then you've got recreation. And then you've got trivial matters like golf courses or whatever, or fountains and aesthetic type things. Again, set priorities so that when we are in trouble, you can just say, well, look at you did this knowing full well that someday you may be shut off because you're not on the top of the priority list. Finally, in certain areas, housing simply should not be built. And this follows into the priority area. Why are we building in floodplains along the Delta? When we know that the Delta levees are in big trouble, there isn't the money to restore them. And yet, as I drive up 160, I see these developments occurring over near Freeport and so on, figuring what kind of morons are we? Why are we building in an area that could easily flood, wipe out, be extremely expensive? Likewise, down in Palm Desert, Palm Springs area, you know, in the old days, and, you know, I remember when Palm Springs folded up in the summer. They didn't have air conditioning to the extent they do now. People would go there in the winter, and then everybody would leave come May. Now you've got huge retirement communities with golf courses, fountains. I mean, some of the hotels down there are unbelievable with their water display. Well, this is nuts. This is crazy. Somebody's coming in, a developer, once again, the old developers coming in with their siren song, promising everybody everything, make their billions, not millions, they make billions on these projects, and give it time, the economy will turn, and they'll be back down there again spending their little song. And what do we get out of it? Nothing. Nothing. And it's crazy. Again, we've got so much water, and we've got so much ability to provide it to people. And somewhere along the line, someone's got to say, this is reality. You know, I was real happy to see our current governor, Governor Brown, finally come out and talk to people about the reality of the budget. You know, we've all been the public has been dreaming.
I haven't noticed any wildly enthusiastic exception of individual cuts, however.
That's life. That's everybody wants a free lunch. That goes back to the Romans. The bottom line is you've got to have somebody that says the free lunch is over. It's done. This is reality. And, you know, I think when people understand what reality is, just like with the budget and now with the water situation, then they can plan. They understand if it's just and fair everybody's treated properly, you can put through a plan. The other problem we face is that this thing comes and wanes with the weather. We go into a dry period, and then everybody thinks about, oh, my God, we're going to have a problem. Then we get heavy winters, and then we all forget about it. Well, that forgetting about, I think, is done. Because one of these days, we're going to come into a real drought, a good 20-year drought. And then, if we don't take care of it now, then we're really going to be in big trouble, just like we are now with the economic budget situation that has descended on us. Didn't come overnight. Took a long while. If anybody had any brains, they would have seen it coming. So with those comments, I thank you, and I look forward to this not just being another hearing where the results are tucked away. I have great faith.
Ms. Donahue, we can do some things, but the bill that created this didn't give us the power to write new laws that weren't implied by this, incorporated in
right.
it. So a number of your suggestions like, you know, no development in places and so on are attractive, but we can't do a Delta plan that precisely does that and have a force of effective law. But we're going to try to do the best we can.
And
by the end of the year.
And I hope, I wish you great success. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lindemuth, you had a follow-up point, I believe?
Yes.
Yes, please. And then if anyone else wants to talk, please bring these up. We promise to get you out of here
this
by 8 o'clock if we can.
This is one I didn't come prepared to talk about tonight, however. Let me start by stating that it's my professional view that additional water needs in Southern California for municipal and industrial purposes clearly can be furnished at an economically viable price via desalination. Now, that's a pretty bold statement. Let me give you a little background, however, so you can see where I'm coming from. When I graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a degree in chemical engineering, I went to work for the largest desalination manufacturer in the world. A short time later, after I joined that company, I was involved in starting up the world's largest desalination plant in a place with a marvelous, thriving economy, Tijuana, Baja California. 7.5 million gallons a day furnished half of their municipal water needs, not far from our borders at all. To the best of my knowledge, that plant, which uses waste heat from a thermal power plant, is still running. And that's half my lifetime, almost. A long time ago. Much later along, when I was a project manager for a small company by the name of Bechtel, who I think you might know, I authored a study for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for the next generation of seawater desalination plants. They would be very big, perhaps 5 to 10 times as big as the plants that are there now. And the plant at El Wusta, for example, stretches 5 miles along the beach and produces over 500 million gallons of pure distilled water every day. And in fact, that whole kingdom exists on only desalinated water, almost all of it produced by thermal processes. There are 2 or 3 2.5-meter diameter pipelines that traverse the entire kingdom. That's almost from coast to coast in the United States, so that they have water reliability. So my point is that very large-scale desalination, not for agricultural purposes, but for purposes that are well within the range that Americans are used to paying, can be done by desalination. That is absolutely true.
Where is Sheikh Yamani now that we need him, right?
Well, yeah. I understand that as part of this experience, I've worked with desalination plants that run, well, more than 1,000 feet below the surface of the ocean. Where do you suppose they were? In nuclear submarines. And I will tell you that they cost 50 times as much as an ordinary desalination plant. But that's part of the reality of going into the deep ocean. It ain't cheap. Sort of a final piece of this, if the commission would be interested. In the past, I did a study looking at the notion of, okay, energy prices for gas and oil and even nuclear are rising and rising and rising. The sun continues to shine for the same price it always does. So would it be possible to run large-scale desalination and perhaps offshore? Because after all, you don't pay land costs offshore, which you have to have lots of land for solar collectors. If you put your solar design power or desalination plant offshore, you would get to an economic breakpoint at a fuel cost of about $60 a barrel for oil. What are we paying for oil these days? About 90, right? So solar desalination might be a real attractive alternative for those communities that are perhaps within 100 miles of the coastline. Further away, of course, it doesn't make sense because then the transportation costs. But you would have absolutely pure water that could be used for almost any purpose. You don't have to run it off into the street because, after all, it doesn't carry in any salts. And it could be done with effectively no carbon footprint at all. So it's really a matter of, obviously, some more technical development, but more importantly, community will to do it. Because as the previous speaker said, there isn't any more water. With the caveat, there's that great big 36,000 part per million lake that lies just to the west of us.
Thank you very much. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's the array of people who submitted a form. Is there anyone else who would like to talk to us? Yes, sir, come forward. I think you came in late. We're taping this meeting, and we'll post it on our website, so when you go to the microphone, get a little close to it, give your name, if you're representing a group or an organization, or any other descriptive material you'd like to give us, if you just start there, please. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Adam Klein. I'm a concerned citizen, and my comment just relates to what some of the other people have said, because I want to bring it back to the scoping of the EIR. I've heard several people talk about desalination, however you want to pronounce it, and so I'd like to request that the concept of doing some desalinization in order to generate additional water so more water can stay in the delta be incorporated into one of the potential alternatives that are evaluated as part of the EIR process.
We are obligated under our statute to promote statewide water conservation, water use efficiencies, and sustainable water use, which is a sentence broad enough to cover that. I should tell you that some people have been arguing to me that the way to do that is to tell San Francisco to close Hetch Hetchy and let them go desalinate the water at their own cost, which usually gets a gigantic explosion from San Francisco. But it's not totally without controversy as an idea. Yeah, but over time, the cost factors are coming closer to surface water.
Or under.
Yeah. Right. Wait a minute. If you're going to talk from the back, get up at the mic so we can get you recorded here. Sir, yes, sir, if you would introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Paul Schwasse. I'm a Concord resident.
Could you spell the last name so we get the court reporter?
I have a blue card submitted.
Oh, did you? Eric, would you bring that up, please?
I'm the owner of PAC, Environmental and Urban Land Use Planning Consulting Services. I'm a Delta boater, Delta fisherman. And thank you for allowing me to address the council on this important topic. My comments may be redundant to some previous comments, but alluded to, but not specifically addressed, and sort of absent in the NOP, the Notice of Preparation, hydrology and biology sections, is the idea, and some people sort of address this, the amount of hydrologic head coming out of the delta that keeps the salinity from coming up from the ocean and the bay, and it also establishes the null zone where the crab nursery is out in the Carquinez Strait. You need to address that issue specifically. That's an off-site impact, but it's an impact that destroying that nursery of Dungeness crabs is something that needs to be addressed, since this was supposed to be the scoping session comments, but I might want to make some other comments now, since everybody is sort of going off. My head's kind of spinning from
You have correctly identified that we're a little off the scoping, but onto our general business, and you should not restrain yourself because of that. So please give us the comments you want to make.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, our first priority to establish or reestablish, restore, and develop a program for protecting the ecological habitat value and indigenous distribution and populations of botanic and zoologic inhabitants of the Delta. Before there is a discussion of plans for diverting any water out of the Delta, that concept should be considered, the hydrologic head concept.
I think you might have come in a bit late, but out at the table is a copy of the statute that we are operating under the law. And one of the things that's in that is we are given the duty to develop a plan consistent with co-equal goals, one of which is clear Delta ecosystem issues, but it's only one. A more reliable water supply for California is the other, and done in a way as best we can do it to recognize the unique characteristic of the Delta. We do not have the option legally to prefer one of the co-equal goals over the other. It would, if we did that, not be co-equal.
Well, I'm not asking you to do that.
I'm asking to consider
this issue as part of the scoping session, it's not described in your notice of preparation here.
That's right. The notice of preparation is the start of the process. The seven versions of the Delta plan that you're going to see between now and the end of the year and the environmental impact that goes along with that will have far more information than anybody wants, and we'll try to collect all the requests from people for inclusion, summarize that, evaluate it, and act accordingly. That's why it's so valuable.
Your NOP describes potential environmental effects of the proposed project and potential alternatives. I'm asking you to look at that issue.
Yeah,
it's an offsite issue.
The project that's mentioned there is the Delta plan. What most people say when they talk about projects, they say, well, that must mean that study that's going on about a new canal or a new ditch or a new tunnel. That language is the Delta plan we have to adopt. And one other thing, the statute tells us the procedure to follow dealing with what's called the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. That's the process Governor Schwarzenegger started in 2006 to study facilities, Delta facilities, that's been going on for 4 years. And if they go through all the hoops that the statute sets up and they adopt a plan, and if the Department of Fish and Game certifies that it meets environmental laws, we're directed to incorporate it in the Delta plan, but any person can appeal the Fish and Game decision to us, which is also controversial among water users, as you might imagine. So we have a potential appellate role regarding a piece of that separate facility plan idea. That will be done, I bet you, a year and a half or 2 years after we adopt the Delta plan, so we can only speculate what they're going to come up
so
with.
So you're telling me that issue will be looked at in the EIR?
It has to be under the requirements of the law.
All right.
But, you know, we're not doing new runs. We're not designing facilities ourselves. This is a Delta plan to serve as a broad-scale planning document, but we'll give a shot at trying to do the best we can with the information that's publicly available dealing with the conventional facilities the other folks are looking at.
Okay. Let's see. So, well, and then it was alluded to the idea of the nutrient load going into the Delta that's destroying some of the fish populations, which is specifically, I think, they didn't mention it, but I understand that the sewage treatment plant, stormwater, or sewage treatment plant in Sacramento does not do much beyond a secondary treatment level, and that's responsible for part of the nutrient load that's destroying the Delta smelt.
You were not here when we talked
about it. I've been here all night.
Okay, well, we've already...
I was here before you were here.
We've already acted to advise the Central Valley Water Control Board that is hearing has taken the enforcement action against Sacramento, but our lead scientist concurs with that piece relating to ammonia, that it's good science, and the council confirmed that decision. So that process is underway, although it's going to be appealed to the State Water Board and probably will wind up in court.
So then as far as the water transfers and diversions, in the impact report, you should be able to look at mitigations to impacts. You wouldn't be creating new legislation. You'd be creating an environmental impact report that says you can mitigate these impacts by doing these certain things. And among them could be, further water conservation legislation as an impact, requiring, consider impact mitigations for all recipients of Delta water exports transfers for urban uses to impose water conservation and or moratoriums on further development so no more water is being used. I think part of the issue, there's several issues with the problems with the fish population in the Delta, and among them is the striped bass population. You can't do anything about it. They're there now. Somebody imported them from the East Coast and as a sport fish, but it's helping destroy the Delta smelt and the salmon population there. I don't know how you can address that or if that can even be addressed. Oh, and then somebody alluded to this, requiring, or as a mitigation to an impact, requiring all recipients of Delta water transfers for agricultural uses to install the drainage field to reduce salinization of those fields when they're flood irrigated, and then impose drip irrigation systems to conserve water for agricultural uses. And I think that concludes my comments. I didn't have time to really review your website or anything.
You know, I really encourage you because you've made a wide-ranging set of ideas. If you give us a memo on this, if you have a chance, that would be very helpful to us.
I can do that. I'll send you an email.
Great.
Or send an email to your
Yeah, please. And
website.
We'll post your comments publicly. So
I'll probably have much more in the way of comments.
No,
by
of course.
That
no,
time
we
when
encourage
I sit down
that.
And look at that. I
no,
just walked right. in here, picked up this document, and looked at it and
well,
listened to
pretty,
what
pretty everybody
Pretty
impressive for
say.
Just looking at it for the first time. So do a more elaborate statement would be helpful.
Certainly.
Good.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Anyone else? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get you out of here by the promised 8 o'clock time. Just a couple comments again. If you're willing to put in writing ideas, suggestions, observations, whatever it is, it's enormously helpful to us. And we'll receive them all the way through this year. And it helps us in preparing these 7 drafts of the Delta Plan and then the Environmental Impact Report and we're starting many more hearings coming up, and very important to get your comments as early as you can so we can start circulating ideas and get reaction to it. So please don't hesitate to let us know. And Mr. Sibley, could you use the microphone because we can't get your voice from the back of the room, even though it's a good booming voice.
Yeah, I know. But I would just like to say that I think the general public really doesn't get enough information to know that some of these meetings are going on. I mean, I may be just speaking for myself, but I'm not always looking for a meeting somewhere. I just, if I pick it up in a newspaper, that's where I've seen it. But, hey, we're counting on all this scientific information from all these people to get this one right this time. I mean, we've got it wrong a lot of times, and we need to make sure that there's an input from the general public as well, so that we don't have to go, see, I told you so, one more time. So I'd appreciate it if you guys would do a little better job of advertising exactly what you're proposing and to the getting it to the people so that they can show up here if they so elect.
Well, do me a favor. Anybody you want to get our information, shoot us their names, their addresses. If they have an email, which would be preferable, we'd add them to the email
list. I'm only talking about the general population. I'm not trying to head up an organization to be on the cutting edge of
advertising. I'm just saying, if there's anybody you know who you think would be interesting, ship us their name, their email address, we'll add them to the distribution list. That's the easiest, fastest, and since this is taxpayer money, the cheapest way to disseminate information for folks, and it's been a godsend for these kinds of complicated studies.
But I don't know how it's a godsend, because I know that most people must not know about it, because I've been to different meetings on this whole water thing over the years, and this is a pretty good turnout for what I've seen at most of them.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
I don't think you're getting a big audience because you're advertising too much.
No comment.
Thank you. Okay. We'll hang around for a few minutes if any of you have any questions, but ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming tonight. Appreciate it very much.